Thank you for joining me. I am Brett Kelly, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast, or check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast fan shop hosted by Teespring. Today's guest is Steph Janikowski Hartley. Stephanie collaborates across disciplines and with communities through engagement and research about our freshwater ecosystems and the diverse ways that we depend on, modify, and relate to them. She is currently a part of the Fire Lab team, a cross-disciplinary group engaging and researching rivers in the UK and around the world. Welcome to the Fisheries Podcast. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks very much, Brett.
So you grew up near Lake Michigan, and now you live in the United Kingdom, but is there anything nearby that rivals the Lake Michigan or is potentially your new favorite water body?
Sure, yeah. So here the local river that flows through Swansea is called the River Tawe. And last year I walked up and down the river four different times across seasons, and that really helped me to connect with this river. It's by no means great in the same kind of size as the Great Lakes Basin or Lake Michigan. It's about 45 kilometers in length from the source down to the sea, but it's a very exciting walk to do, and you cross many different landscapes. And I guess in some ways, there's some similarities between the River Tawe, especially when you reach the urban areas with post-industrial landscape, but also some differences in terms of how modified the river is and how long it's been modified compared to the rivers that grew up near in the Great Lakes Basin. And it's also quite interesting more broadly across the UK to visit different rivers and get to see them all. Another river that I really enjoy is the River Severn, and we're doing starting some work with the Severn Rivers Trust, looking at dam removals and kind of the effectiveness of that. So it's another river that I enjoy visiting and lucky to have a project there.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, like you said, might not have the fame and allure like the Great Lakes do, but I'm a huge proponent of trying to find your local water. And I'm big rivers fan, always have done work in rivers and streams, and there's just something about rivers that sort of draw me in. But so what made Lake Michigan special for you that made you want to dig deeper, maybe begin your life as a scientist, or something that made you know that you wanted to interact with it more than just a recreational level?
Yeah, I guess for me, I actually think I'm a bit like you, and I got really connected by working on the rivers that flow to Lake Michigan when I started my undergraduate degree at Grand Valley State University. And we did a program called Natural Resources Management, which most of our classes and lab work were done outside. And I was just really fascinated by the potential of getting to work outside for the rest of my life. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. And I really connected with the systems that we worked on. And in terms of Lake Michigan, I think also just the chance as a young person to get to visit Lake Michigan and the dune systems that were there. And then as I got older, recognizing just how incredible those are and how unique that whole ecosystem is and how lucky I was to grow up nearby there, really just connected with me and started to solidify my interest in working on these aquatic systems.
That's awesome. Yeah, I didn't know you went to Grand Valley. That I've had a couple of acquaintances from there that were doing some brook trout work that I've talked to while I was doing my graduate research at Iowa State. I also read on your website that you have a desire to better our understanding of the natural world and the diverse relationships that exist between humans and nature. What are potentially some key insights from your research thus far, or maybe some big takeaways that have led you to a new understanding of those connections?
Yeah, I guess something that's always ongoing in this area of research is that we're increasingly understanding the complexity of relationships that people form with different things. So you might have positive and negative relations or perspectives on different things, and how those frame are probably based on your engagement with them at different points in your life. Something that we're working on now is using poetry and art as a way to engage with people about underwater environments. So our focus is on rivers, but of course we can think of underwater as marine environments or lake, underwater lake environments as well. And getting people to just think about and write about those systems. And then when we have their writing, we look at the content within there and look at different messages that might be emerging. And that might be one snapshot in time of someone's perspective of that day, what they're thinking about. But if we look at that over time and across the project, then we can start to maybe gather a broader understanding of different ways that people connect with these ecosystems. And here locally, one of our goals is to work more broadly within the community. It's been a bit of a challenge now this year with COVID-19, but we're hoping to do some more kind of local-based projects that build on that, using art and poetry to gather people's relations and perspectives on the local freshwater ecosystems.
Well, that's great. It's a question that I often think about, because during my master's work, I worked with private landowners. And then here in my new job, I'm also going to have to be, speaking to members of the public and working with private landowners to do habitat restoration projects. And one thing I've often thought about is, generally in our field, we often think that pretty much everyone always has positive thoughts and positive relationships with most aspects of natural resources. But I certainly think that it is often sort of underappreciated or not really thought about all that much, that, you know, there's many people out there that don't exactly share our exact values. And have you had instances where you've interacted with, members of the community or the public, where, you know, they don't necessarily always have positive connotations or thoughts about certain aspects of natural resources and how to maybe approach that conversation?
Yeah, so, I mean, I would say generally there's always going to be kind of broad different perspectives, but I have generally found that having discussions with people is pretty open, and I think it's important that we all recognize we have different perspectives, but also recognizing that there might be a way for us to kind of find a middle ground with some of these things, particularly around topics, something that I'm working on now with things like dam removal or dam remediation. And this is quite a complicated topic in the end. I think in some ways, when people set out to approach these kinds of projects, it seems like, oh, it's a no-brainer, we'll go ahead and remove this dam. But as you say, many people have different relationships with that dam, and we might think, oh, that dam is negative because it's having a very big impact on the freshwater ecosystem, it's modifying it, etc. But for different people, that dam could have different values. For example, for fishing, different people who depend on and use different recreational fishing could prefer that the dam stays in place because it keeps the fishery going that they use and depend on and like to spend their weekends doing. And I think the same can be said for other values as well. Maybe in the case that someone does want the dam to be removed because it would return more natural rapids to the river system. I know this is something that's come up in discussions on the Grand River in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in terms of different values that emerge with different stakeholders that have been in discussions about potential dam removal projects. And we see different kind of contexts around different scenarios, but similar kinds of situations around all dam removal projects. It's not always a clean cut decision, and there's a lot of complexities around heritage, around the age of the infrastructure, about the different stakeholders involved, etc. So yeah, it is complicated, but I think having these discussions is important, and it gets us started on thinking about what it is we want and how people want to see their waterscapes now and into the future.
And that's such a brilliant example, because that's, you know, as I said earlier, being someone who works and often thinks about rivers and streams, that's immediately where my mind goes, is the, you know, the conversations centered around dams and the positive and negative things that, you know, people have built up over time, relationships or even experiences that they may have had. And I think you bring in fishing, which is a great way that, you know, people often have interesting conversations about, because like you said, people might enjoy the fishing below the dam, but also too, you know, fish passage for, you know, the conservationist and management perspective is also really important. So I love that example. It's a great example. And you've talked about this a little already, but what would you say are some projects that you have been a part of most recently, or potentially are coming down the pipe for you?
Yeah, so one that we're quite excited about and we're working actively with Seven Rivers Trust is to look at kind of the characteristics, I guess we can say, that are associated with kind of the probability of success or likelihood of someone engaging in dam removal or remediation. And also interested in what are these factors that might make different individuals willing to undertake this remediation. So in the UK, I can't speak so much for the US, and it might vary by state actually, but in the UK, different people own dams, and I'm sure that's the case in the US. And that varies also, kind of urban areas tend to be owned more by government or local government. And in rural areas, individuals tend to own the infrastructure. And so the different people that you have involved with any decision around dam removal can vary at any time. And so it can be quite interesting to maybe do a before and after study to look at, okay, what are people's perspectives on this dam removal before and then going through the removal and after. And of course, there's not always just removal, but there's different variations of those projects. So speaking with Severn Rivers Trust, they've told us that it's not just about removal. In some cases in the UK, you can't always remove the infrastructure because it's attached to a house because it's super old and it's from the 1600s,
Oh, wow.
sometimes, or you can't remove the infrastructure completely because it would have an impact on flooding. But you could create a fish pass, as you say, or kind of a bypass open channel that goes around to the infrastructure. So there's also different kind of pathways and solutions that people find. And we're basically interested in how does this kind of evolve throughout the process and capturing this through different case studies.
Huh, that's neat. Yeah, one way they've done something similar. It's not, of course, the same analysis, but most recently, living in Iowa, what they have done and found great success with is in a certain amount of times where they've removed dams completely, they've replaced it with a project to create small rapids and create like a little whitewater park for people to come and tube down or kayak down or, you know, just to hang out for the day by the rapids. And they've seen a lot of success with people using it and people having, you know, positive thoughts around it, because not only was it just dam removal, and as you said, it doesn't always stop there, they went ahead and put in, you know, additional structures to create flows that would be, you know, fun for people to interact with. So they've seen a lot of positive attitudes about the project because they implemented things for people to actually engage with afterwards. And they've seen fishermen that, you know, were adamant that the dam should remain in place because the fishing was so good below the dam, that have had success near those rapid structures as well. So it seems like a good solution for a couple different, you know, sides. So provides passage and it also provides recreation. So I thought that was cool.
That's definitely cool. And actually, speaking with Mike Morris at Seven Rivers Trust a few weeks ago, they said something similar. They have done that, maybe I think in one or two scenarios, or at least the people, local people asked for that, putting kind of rhapiddy. So to some people, it's like the aesthetic or the sound of the dam actually is really important to them. And so putting those Rocky Rapids in give a very similar sound. Maybe it's not as strong and you have to be closer by because the rapids, but yeah, so that's really great. And they seem to have similar positive feedback here as well.
Well, it's good to know that it's not just Iowa
Indeed.
then. So, what would you say from all of this work that you've been doing was maybe your, biggest accomplishment or potentially a pet project that you've worked on that you think of often?
So, well, we have a kind of surprise coming out for World Fish Migration Day that might potentially take over this, but right now, on the record, there's a project we've been working on with a book for local young people that is about a local dog that's called Jack. Many years ago was around called, and they now call it Swansea Jack, but we've made a rendition of this, like a character of, like say, a niece who are offspring of the original Swansea Jack. And she takes a travel up the Tawi River and goes on an adventure. And through that text, we also interweave different concepts about geology and hydrology and the local landscape. And we've got some fun activities at the end of that. So I think from a team perspective, because pretty much the, I believe the whole team at the time, we all contributed to that. And that was really rewarding. And I think it also feels nice to give something back to the local community and chatting with people about the book here locally. Also, people have just said how excited they are to have something that's written about their local river and about Swansea. So that's really nice feedback.
Well, that's definitely cool. And a little tease for everyone to tune in to everything surrounding, was it World Fish Migration Day, I believe it
Yeah,
is?
World
Like,
Fish Migration
yeah,
Day. Definitely tune in.
it's a mouthful, so I didn't want to mess it up. But yeah, that's definitely cool. I think that's a big thing for a lot of people is that they want to feel like they're a part of the conversation or that things that they find special, even if it's a rural community or a small town community, they have, just as much value as things that are found to be special in, larger metropolis areas or larger rivers. There is value in small creeks and headwater streams, just like there's value in the Great Lakes, so to speak. So
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
I think that's definitely a cool thing to get them involved and have their story out there, I guess.
Absolutely. And yeah, and I think saying on that about the small streams and things is like also awareness of just how important these small ecosystems are, and many small ecosystems add up to be big ones. I mean, the Mississippi River starts from many, many small tributaries, doesn't it? So one grand river is made from many sources. So yeah, I think it's a really nice way to capture that, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. So when people hear that you're a member of the fire lab, they might maybe initially think that you research fire ecology or something of that sort. But can you tell us more about, what fire lab stands for and what it is, and maybe fire lab kids as well?
Yeah, so Fire Lab is Freshwater Interdisciplinary Research and Engagement Lab. We're based at Swansea University in Swansea here in Wales in the UK. The story behind Fire Lab is that when I got the fellowship to come here, they said, oh, like you'll do fine as long as you don't cause any fires or burn the place down. And so I was like, oh, okay. So I'll use that as an acronym, fire. Yeah, fresh water, that works.
Right.
So that's kind of the story behind that. And the team, at the moment, there's three of us researchers, and we were about five earlier this year. We're a mix of ecologists, geographers, conservation and environmental scientists, and also social scientist and an artist. So we are, I guess we can say, truly interdisciplinary, and we do approach questions from a interdisciplinary perspective. And I think if I can put my finger on a specific point that kind of guided me in this direction is probably, again, my undergraduate education and going to, through a liberal arts degree and program and having access to these different perspectives and recognizing that it's important not just to have one lens that you look at things through. So yeah, that's Fire Lab. And in terms of like key projects we have going on, there's the Underwater Haiku project. So that's out on social media and that's trying to recruit different people to participate with us in writing haiku and getting creative and working collaboratively about underwater environments. And we have the Jack's River Adventure. And then we have the surprise project that's coming out for World Fish Federation Day. Okay, it involves trout. I will say that.
That'll definitely get people excited.
Yeah. And then questions about basically mapping in-stream infrastructure, which, you know, the world over, we have a really bad understanding of where different infrastructure occur, especially smaller infrastructure like road culverts, which are probably less known than dams or weirs by most people. And then we're working on questions about removal projects and kind of what works and what doesn't with those projects. So it's kind of a broad list, but yeah. It definitely keeps us busy.
Well, I guess that's why that you guys put the interdisciplinary in there, because you certainly are that.
Definitely.
And how long have you been a member, or when did you start?
The group started in end of 2018.
Okay.
So we've been going about 2 years, and the program, or like the initial funding, goes until the end of 2022. So we have a couple of years to go still on this project.
Yeah, you guys have tackled a lot in a short amount of time. That's pretty neat.
We're trying. It's been pretty crazy, 2020, because it's we managed to actually get things done. And it's like, okay, how is this happening? But we're just going.
Yeah, it has been such a difficult year for so many people. So
I know.
Kudos to you guys for, you know, keeping up with it.
Thanks very much.
So I feel like scientists can often be viewed as information snobs or people that have all the details but aren't willing to share. And then potentially sometimes when we do share, it's written with jargon and, you know, language that's not necessarily common speak. But I feel like you've rewritten this script with all of that outreach and engagement that you and Fire Lab have been a part of. What clicked with you that sort of helped you know that all of this engagement, communication was really important and therefore needed this amount of effort?
Yeah, I guess there's probably one point and maybe even one person I can give thanks to for that. I would say initial work on World Fish Migration Day around 2014, 2015, with maybe someone that the fisheries podcast people know, Solomon David. Yes, he, I think, is probably pretty well known around here.
He is.
He and I worked together with other colleagues to put together an activity at Shedd Aquarium in Chicago around 2014, I think it was. And I think through chats with Solomon and even just going through that process of creating the materials and the activity and leading the day and just seeing the sparks and the excitement on all of the people's face that engaged with us during that day really solidified for me the importance of engagement and in reaching out with people and just talking about the things that excite us. And I think Solomon is a great example of someone who's really shown how sharing your excitement and passion with people can get others excited too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting that you have that connection, because he actually was on the show and I was doing his interview as well. And I asked him a question almost identical to this one, because he does so much, you know, social media engagement and elsewhere too. It's not just social media, but it's really funny that you guys have a mutual contact and that was your answer, because yeah, he does the same thing. He makes extra effort and extra time to make sure that you know, all the work that he's doing is not just in a vacuum, and he wants to get it out there. He wants people to understand and interact with it. So that's awesome. Another way that you've engaged with the scientific community as well as the public is through your Twitter profile. So what is, or maybe was, I guess, hashtag damn or not?
Right. So damn or not was kind of phrased after a very famous Twitter game called Cougar or Not, which was started by Michelle LaRue and is still going, I believe. And damn or not started after I shared some work that we are doing in France to map and identify in-stream infrastructure like dams, weirs, and culverts, and me sharing pictures and just showing how tricky it is to actually determine what a structure is, if it's a structure, and maybe what that impact could be just from using remote satellite imagery, because it's very challenging actually to visit all of these things on ground. It gets very costly and it takes a lot of time. So we use different tools like satellite imagery to quote unquote visit these places from a remote desktop, basically. And someone said, oh, you should make this a game and turn it into something like hashtag damn or not. Actually, the person that said it is Taryn Murray. She works in South Africa. And she was like, this could be a very interesting game. And that was in 2016 in the summer. And then I just kind of took it from there. And whether the Twitter world wanted it or not, it kind of evolved into a weekly game of damn or not and getting people, poor souls, to look at satellite imagery and ID different infrastructure.
Well, I think the Twitter world definitely welcomed it with open arms. I found it a little bit later on into it, but definitely thought it was super interesting and also a fun game. It's not as easy as it sounds.
No. And I mean, in the end, it was really great because we've built a community from that Twitter game, and we have a kind of a group chat of, it's called Damn Enthusiasts. I should get t-shirts made, I feel like, but it's like just very nerdy discussions about dam and infrastructure and our waterways. But some of those people actually ended up contributing to a participatory science project that we led with colleagues at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Okay.
UNC Chapel Hill, yeah. Tamlin Pavelski in his lab there. And so that was really nice that people that spent years contributing to damn or not and sharing and engaging with it then contributed to scientific research project. And we published that work earlier this year, and there were co-authors on it, and that was really exciting. And just helped even build our relationship more and solidify that more. And some of them are even engaged with me on additional work here in the UK, so it's pretty
very
exciting.
Cool. Yeah, that's awesome. It's so interesting what a Twitter connection can do. And for example, I'm only a co-host of this podcast because of Twitter, because Nick was going through getting ready to, you know, their family was having a child, and he was like, well, I'm going to need to have some additional time for myself. So he put a call to arms, so to speak, on Twitter, and I reached out and was like, you know, I don't know what capacity it would be, but I'd love to get involved. I think, you know, this is a really cool platform and I love podcasts, and I guess here I am. There's good and there's bad to social media, but definitely
I know there
can be some good too. So,
but the good stuff is really good, and that's two really great examples of connecting. And it's something that I tend to say if I give talks or talk with students about social media. I mean, obviously there's a way to kind of go overboard with it or use it in an unhealthy way, but you know, for those types of interactions, it's also very useful and important for young people or students, not necessarily young, who may not, you know, who are new to a field or new to an area. And it's not so easy to just go up and talk to someone at a conference or in person. So reaching out on something like Twitter is actually less scary in some ways, because right. If you write to someone in a private message and they don't respond, you're like, oh, okay. But yeah, but if they do respond, you're like, oh, wow, okay, thanks. Yeah, just wanted to share this thing.
Right.
So
Yeah, it's and it's a great way for us to interact with people that might be potential guests on the show. For example, I only recently came across your Twitter and I started doing more digging, and it was through Damn or Not that, I found out who you were and was super interested. So, yeah,
Awesome.
it's definitely cool. Well, I guess that was all the formal questions that I had listed, but is there anything that you were wanting to discuss or passionate about before we move on to the final questions?
I think maybe one thing is, like I mentioned, the Damn Memorable projects. But just maybe to emphasize that a lot of the work that the team at Fire Lab, especially the spatial mapping side, and also some of the people from Damn or Not, a lot of the work that we've been doing in the last year is to do with the smaller infrastructure, so at road river crossings. So trying to tease apart if a structure is a culvert, a bridge, a ford, or if it's not really a road crossing at all. And we've now almost, they tell me, all of the powers that be that are the spatial mappers, they say that we've almost finished Wales with validating all of the sites that we had initially mapped. And
Wow.
so that's also, it's a huge feat. And it's really with thanks to people from Damn or Not, like Michael, he's volunteered his time on this. And then student here, Lynn, she's an intern with us, and research assistant, Siley, who has now just actually moved on to do a PhD. But it's really because of their hours of work that this has been possible, because currently there's really no other way to validate these things unless, we can't put that many boots on the ground to do it. It just takes way too much time.
Right.
And things like machine learning or AI algorithms are not quite there yet, and the imagery just isn't good enough to facilitate that. So it's taken a lot of all hands on deck, but we're making good progress. And I think that's exciting too for those people that have contributed.
That's definitely exciting. And yeah, you bring up a great point that it's probably not the flashiest item, or when people think of Fish Passage, it's definitely, or it might not be what, people's minds immediately go to. But again, in some of these headwater systems, those are big enough to cause an impediment that's, functionally equivalent to, large dams that might be downriver. So that, like you, that's a big feat to map it all out. And it'll be hopefully, really informational for people moving forward and potentially some cool restoration projects.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we hope. And we hope to make it available for groups here that are interested in this, like the different river trusts and the government agencies. So it's exciting.
Yeah. So you've mentioned that I think it's the Seven Rivers Trust a couple of times. What exactly is that? Or is that just based out of the UK, or is that a global
Yeah,
organization?
so in the UK, they're called River Trusts. I think that they're kind of like a non-government entity, but they get money from the government that's routed to them to focus on river-based projects. And these trusts exist all over the UK. And at least for Severn Rivers Trust, a big focus at the moment is dam removal. They had a project that was called Unlocking the Severn, which was about, opening up the Severn River basically and making it more permeable for things like shad, which is a migratory species that declined really heavily here in the UK and across a lot of Europe, actually across France as well. So that's a big part of their work, but also public engagement around rivers is a big part of their work. And yeah, I think there might be other things like pollution as well that they focus on.
Okay. So what are some maybe the big differences that you see now living in the UK, whether it be conservation mindedness or management practices, or relatively simple things like the way people greet each other? I don't know. Like, are there any things that were hard to get used to or big surprises for you when you moved?
Yeah, I guess the full disclaimer is that I haven't really lived in the US for almost 20 years. I think I spent 2 years
Okay.
there in Madison for a postdoc. But then I was in Australia almost 10 years before that for my
Oh,
PhD.
cool.
So I've kind of, and then some time in France as well. So I've kind of spent time in different places. But yeah, differences. I think maybe there's more similarities than differences, but I think probably most people think I'm a bit loud and obnoxious as an American in the UK, but I'm okay with that. I recognize it and I try to like hone it in. I know, but like just be quiet sometimes. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. That's very funny. Well, I guess the formal part of the interview is now over, and we typically have a list of questions that we ask all of our guests, and we always start nice and simple. What is your favorite fish?
I actually think that is the hardest question on
It's such,
the
such,
planet.
it's
How can
impossible.
someone called the Fisheries Podcast set that up to us? I mean, seriously, you know that is very hard for all of us.
It's impossible to answer, but
Okay, so here is another disclaimer. There is a group of fishes, which I don't think we have very good species level information for. So I will say the Cicadaceae, which is these gobies that live in the South Pacific and that I did some work on during my PhD and I've recently worked on with colleagues in Papua New Guinea as well. Yeah, these little gobies are ones that are known to kind of quote unquote climb up waterfalls, use
Oh, right.
their little crest bird mouth like suckers and the fused pelvic fin to move up waterfalls and fast flowing streams in that area. I'm very partial to them.
That's
And I don't
awesome.
think I can say just one species. And if I
Yeah.
did, it would probably change species name like next month. So
Oh, that's funny. So, what all did you do for your PhD research with the gobies, or maybe other things besides gobies too?
Yeah, so I did some field work, which was sampling streams across the wet tropics, which is a region in Australia that is actually wet. It's the wettest part, I think I can
Oh.
say with confidence. It gets some of the highest rainfall, annual rainfall in Australia. But actually, in Australia is also where I got interested in working on projects with landholders, like what you're doing, it sounds like, or similar to, anyways. And getting a better understanding of people's perceptions of different conservation projects that groups might be proposing. And we also did some work on invasive species management. That was focused on a plant, actually, not on fish. And we worked with local government on that and trying to come up with different potential solutions and priorities for where local government might put actions in place to try and mitigate the spread of that invasive species. So a lot of the work was kind of in the field of systematic conservation planning and just basically more applied conservation in general.
Nice. Any key findings from your PhD research that of note or maybe put you down a path towards future projects from that point on?
Yeah, it's not a direct finding per se. I don't think I noted it in the thesis, but because in Australia that we tend to write like paper chapters, so we publish a paper and then that's a chapter in the thesis. So it's not quite as not necessarily as reflective as maybe some theses that are in the US, like not as big, for example. And like I was saying, I think one thing that I definitely took from that was just the different voices that are important in conservation and how we can hear those voices and just recognizing the challenges that exist with doing different projects in a very dynamic and diverse landscape and recognizing that maybe some voices are heard more than others and maybe those voices that we don't hear are the ones that we do need to hear to better understand kind of what's going on and where limitations might be. And I think that I mostly got from working with local government, visiting land, different landholders' properties and talking with them and then doing that further work to kind of engage and develop surveys and interviews with them, which was really valuable and really opened me to a different way of research and generally probably a different philosophy as well.
Very neat. So as you mentioned, you've lived in a couple of different places now, and you've had a variety of jobs and research positions. But if you had to pick a dream job or location, would there be one? A lot of people say exactly what they're doing at the time, because we have a lot of passionate folks that we interview. So most people are already at their dream job. But what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I really love what I'm doing, but probably you could sense that I wouldn't mind moving back to the tropics into Northern Australia, or even, I mean, it's a bit more challenging to move to Papua New Guinea, but that region and those two places are very near and dear to my heart. And yeah, I mean, I would love to continue doing work in either of those places.
Yeah, I've never had the opportunity to travel, especially that far from home, but definitely would love to see Australia and maybe go see some gobies. I don't know. That might be all private land and they might be endangered or something. I'm not even sure. So.
They might be out at sea at the time. Yeah, that's what we thought. And then we found some. You never know.
That's super cool. So if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head that listens to this episode, what do you think that would be?
I'm going to hook it on the small in-stream infrastructure and say that not only dams and weirs exist on our waterways, it's important to also think about our smaller infrastructure that is associated with things like roads that are also more pervasive and less understood in our waterscapes.
Yeah, that's a great way to end the show. I think it sums up that message that you've tried to weave into a lot of your answers. So that's great.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for being a guest on the show, and I really appreciated chatting with you. If people wanted to connect with some of the things that you have going on or learn more about you or FireLab, where are some places that they can find you?
Yeah, so I'm at Connected Waters on Twitter. And for FireLab, it's also quite easy. It's firelaboratory.uk, and we also have firelabkids.uk. Two websites, one kind of our blog with the firelaboratory.uk, and then specific engagement and enrichment materials for kids on Fire Labs UK.
Thank you to everyone for listening to the 89th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at bbk_95. The podcast is at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode, and you can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I'm Brett Kelly, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, it's important to think about small stream infrastructure.